So the title of my talk tonight is Achi Mo. Mo is the Tibetan term for divination, a dice divination of a Tibetan deity. I've been always interested in Tibetan divination, and I actually got this text maybe 20 years ago from its publisher, Sendu Senge, my friend, but I never had really the opportunity to study it. And so now I'm really very grateful that this institution here provides me the chance to actually enter into a study of it and to benefit especially from the massive experience and expertise that has been built up in this institution. But I have to apologize right at the beginning, of course. As I said, I'm a total beginner on this field of studies, and I'm just 7 weeks into it. So I hope that at least some bits of my talk are of some interest for you. My talk will have four parts. At first, I would like to start with a brief discussion of this deity, of the nature of this deity. I will talk about the Achi Mo text itself a bit, especially about the structural and technical similarities with other divination texts. And thirdly, I would like to talk about divination in the context of Mahayana Buddhism. And finally, my fourth point is to allow some reflections on the process through which Buddhism absorbs seemingly foreign elements, and these reflections should be an impetus for reflecting especially on the high mobility of divination texts and structures and techniques across languages and cultures and even across vast geographical distances. So I would like to start, as I said, with a very few remarks on the nature of that deity, and for that I want to explain something because I think that maybe some of you are not familiar with this kind of terminology. So when we talk about the Buddha and about the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, then usually we think it's the Buddha's Dharma. But there are certain perspectives we can take and certain aspects that need to be kept in mind. An interesting perspective is given by the Buddha himself. Towards the end of his life, he was visited by a monk who became monk very late in his life. And then he was for a long time sick, and so he was unable to see the Buddha. And finally, when he saw the Buddha, he complained to the Buddha and said, "Oh, now I'm so late, and this may be the last time I see you, and this is such my bad karma," and so on. So the Buddha replied to that, "What benefit is it to see my rotting body? Whoever sees the Dharma sees me." And also in another sutra, he said, "The Dharma, the teachings, is my actual body." So after the Buddha's death, the Dharma was regarded to be the Buddha. And we have to remember in this context that the Dharma was at that time transmitted orally. So to recite or to listen to the Dharma was like seeing the Buddha. At least that was the idea. But what was the Dharma? In that context, it is interesting that the Buddha himself pointed out that for him the Dharma was not his Dharma, but that he was discovering it. And he made gave an interesting example. He said in the Nagara Sutta, "Suppose, because a man wandering through the forest would see an ancient path traveled upon by people in the past, an ancient city inhabited by people in the past, so too, because I saw the ancient past traveled by perfectly enlightened ones of the past." So what he is saying is that the Dharma is not really the Buddha's, but it exists throughout space and time, and it has been discovered by him. The Pali Sutra, the early sutras, speak also in several places of pilgrimages. Of 24 previous Buddhas, and of course there are future Buddhas like Maitreya and so forth. So the idea that the Dharma is there, something, you know, like an Ur-Dharma or whatever you want to call it, that is beyond the actual Buddha that is being visible here, that exists throughout space and time, is there. And this Dharma will then be called at some point Dharmakaya. Kaya is one of the Sanskrit terms for body. So Dharmakaya is the Buddha body. It means it is that kind of Dharma, the teaching, that exists throughout space and time, but is only perceptible to someone who reaches awakening for the Buddha, and it's not perceptible for ordinary beings. So we have here at this point two kayas, two bodies of the Buddha. One is the Dharmakaya, which is not visible, where the real Dharma is to be discovered. And the other one is the Nirmanakaya. Here you see this wonderful Greek-inspired depiction of the Buddha. So, and this is his manifestation form that ordinary people can see. So at first there was seeing the Dharma is seeing the Buddha, and that there's a typical reversal of that, of course, seeing the Buddha is seeing the Dharma. But Buddha has died. Shakyamuni died and he was not visible anymore. So there is a third kind of body. And that, because the Dharmakaya is not available to ordinary beings and even to trained people, it's only visible to highly trained people. And the Buddha is not there anymore. So the idea was that through practice, through recollection of the Buddhas, through dreams, visions, and meditative practices, samadhi, a Buddha could be visible and in an ideal form, and that would be called the Sambhogakaya. So why I am telling you this is that our deity, Achi Chukidharma or Achi Dharmatara, is in fact all three. Oops. So these are both depictions of Achi. The one is a slightly more peaceful form. It's the one of also with the divination. But she embodies all three kayas, all three bodies of the Buddha, because she is not only a deity, a lamo, she's also considered to be a Buddha. She is considered to be fully awakened. Secondly, she is also a Sambhogakaya, visible in dreams, visions, and meditation, and that is depicted through her dress and ornaments. That's the usual way that Sambhogakaya deities are shown. And she's also a Nirmanakaya because she has lived. She was the great-grandmother of a great Tibetan master in the 11th century. So she embodies all three. And that is also, this is the form that is practiced in the context of the divination. This is also that attached to the divination is a meditation manual, a quite detailed one, which has prayers and praises and visualizations and so forth. And it also contains mantras. Here is the mantra that is to be practiced for gaining an insight into the deity Achi. And secondly, here is a mantra that is practiced for the dice. So you recite the mantra and then you're supposed to blow on the dice so that the dice are loaded with her energy. So she's standing on the Mara, and so she's even more also depicting a tantric deity, a so-called Dakini. That means that she's very powerful, and she's also considered in her other form, sitting on the horse, here on the blue horse, she's considered to be a protectress. So there she holds in her right hand a drum, and here she holds in her right hand up there. So this is the drum here, and here she holds in her right hand a mirror that shows past, present, and future. Um, It is said in the text that it is necessary to practice the meditation of Aci until a certain, not a very clear sign appears. So it is not just as in many other Dais divination where you have to recite a verse and then you can do the divination. Here in this case it is explicitly said, and it's also my informants tell me, that it needs a lot of practice until certain signs appear that one has a connection to the Sambhogakaya deity of Aci. The second point that I want to, so this is just a general introduction to the deity, the nature of the deity. The second point that I want to make are the structural similarities that I see between this Dais divination and many other divinations. Generally, we can say that we have divinations, at least in Tibet, that have a vision, that produce a vision that is in no way pre-structured. For example, by looking at a certain lake, or by looking into a mirror, suddenly a vision appears, and that is the divination. Or we have pre-structured signs, for example, with flames, birds, shoulder blades, and so forth. So for example, then we have a little booklet, and you use a butter lamp, and then depending on how long the flame is burning, or what kind of color it has, and so on, you can look it up into the manual. So you have a pre-structured kind of divination. And you have, of course, what is very familiar to you too, the producing of random signs, like with sticks or shells or dyes. In our case, we have dyes, and in the Tibetan dyes divinations, we have four-sided dyes and six-sided dyes, something that Brendan has worked on a lot and also published articles on, and there's another one coming, forthcoming, that goes into very much details of Tibetan dyes. But let me just say that the four-sided dyes usually produce 64 results, and the six-sided dyes usually 16 results. It also has an elementary poetry at the before each of the possible throws. So in our case, we have a six-sided dice, and we have 16 results. And at the beginning of each divination, of these 16 divinations, there's a bit of poetry, sometimes only a line, sometimes several lines. This is something that we find also in many other divination manuals throughout the world, actually. And like the Turkic ones have a lot of animal images in them, or you find many local images in them, like concerning the landscape, or you have religious symbols, as it is the case in our Acimo. Furthermore, another structural similarity between many divination manuals is that they are balanced in a certain way. Usually we have more good than bad results. The ratio is circa 2-1, right? I would say, and this is overwhelmingly the case. I only found two Chinese texts that are exactly balanced, 50-50. But usually we have this more good divinations than bad ones, much more good. And furthermore, as you are probably aware, if we look at the questions that you can ask to the divination in a pre-structured divination manual, you see so many similarities across cultures and languages and religions. For example, you have these questions for the household or the home, danger to the life or the life force or health, general undertaking, something that you want to do but which is not specified here. You have questions for diseases and recovering from disease. Of course, business, trade, journeys, and quite interesting also, fighting enemies. But this will be the theme of a workshop that we will do next month, Petra and Brendan and Rolf and I, on optional violence and divination manuals. We have wealth and so forth, fame, marriage, making matches, friends, building homes, lost items. I only found one with hunting. Yeah. I think that was a Bumble. No, that's that's a Bumble divination manual. Demons, evil spirits, winning a young maiden, a Sanskrit text, family line, and so on. Of course, medicine. In my Achimo, we have the question of whether the doctor is appropriate or whether it would be good to change the doctor. Also, the medicine and the treatment, which is treated together. Medicine and treatment, is it appropriate or should it be changed? Then lawsuits and so forth. So we have a great similarity across a vast sample of divination manuals regarding these questions. Then, very particularly in the Buddhist divination manuals, we often have ritual means that can be applied whenever there is a divination that's worse than upper medium. So from there on, usually there are antidotes, so to speak, mentioned in the form of rituals or in the form of just the suggestion to practice virtuous conduct like refuge, confessions, or other methods of merit accumulation and so on, peaceful rituals, wrathful rituals if there is danger for life and through enemies and so forth. So these antidotes we find especially in Tibet, and we find them more in Buddhist divination manuals. The Achimo has a sadhana. It works with random signs. It uses three six-sided dice. It has 16 possible results, starting from 3 to 18. Of course, 111 is 3. It has religious verses. It has twice as much good results than bad. It has these categories that I've shown you and the antidotes. So I was able to conduct two interviews. Let me see if I can. So this is one of the diviners that I interviewed. His name is Antul Rinpoche. Interestingly, this is in Germany, in North Germany, in Schneverding, and it is inside a temple, and this temple is dedicated to Achi. And so you can see in the altar, you see here the Achi with the Dhamma room, with the drum, and riding on the horse. And he is very famous for being a diviner of this special method. He told me that he was practicing this since childhood. Now, the way I approached the interviews with my informants was that I confronted them with a puzzle, with a problem. And the problem is that some years ago I found in the colophons of Ameshab a short remark at the end of one text that I found very interesting. That remark said, "Today I finished writing this text, and in the night I dreamed of Mahakala," which is a Buddhist deity, coming over the mountain on the backside of our monastery. And I went to my guru and asked him, Muchen Sangye Rinchen, and asked him, "Is this a good sign or is it a bad sign?" And the guru answered, "Well, somehow it's a good sign because you saw a deity in a dream that is supposed to be good. But on the other hand, it's also not so good because after all, it's just illusionary thoughts." So for which the term is namtok in Tibetan or vikalpa in Sanskrit. So it's both somehow, he says. So not a positive sign, since it is a dream, and a dream is just a confused appearance of the mind, or it is also somehow not so negative, since at least it is a pure vision of a deity that you have seen, so which is somehow purifying some of your karmic veils. So I asked my informants, isn't that the same thing in the divination? Isn't it also somehow a mundane thing? And how could you confront such a Buddha like Achi with such mundane questions like business? So isn't there a tension? And I ask also another informant, that is Kenshin Nima Gyaltsen, and he's very learned, and he I will quote some of the things that he said during the interview. He said that an authentic Dharma practitioner, of course, does not differentiate into good or bad, and he doesn't hang his hopes or he doesn't have fears about anything. So it wouldn't be really appropriate for an advanced Dharma practitioner to use divination. There are many examples of similar things. For example, one great Tibetan master, Gampopa, is said to have had a direct vision of a Buddha, and he went to his master, the yogi Milarepa, the famous yogi Milarepa, and Milarepa said, "That's nothing particularly good or bad. It's just movements of the wind in your inner channels. And therefore, based on that, it's an illusion. Don't hang your hopes on it. Don't have any fear." So this point also remains true. My informants never try to argue that away. So there is a certain tension between divination and the highest Buddhist goal of awakening. And there's also a tension between being an advanced yogi and making mo's. And in fact, an advanced yogi would not make a mo for himself, and he would be very reluctant to make one for others. For example, Milarepa never did any mo practice as far as we know. So there's this tension between religious practitioner or serious religious practitioner and ordinary people on the other side. In this context, I mean, interesting. Oh, no, I think I jump over that. But what I found out in my discussion with him is that questions about health and so on, and about avoiding dangers for life, are to some extent understandable and should be of concern for the Dharma practitioner, because although there is a tension between the soteriological goal of awakening and business success, still a question about health and so on would be of concern for the Buddhist practitioner, because staying healthy and prolonging one's life is a favorable condition for Dharma practice. And so it is indirectly conducive to becoming a Buddha. So on the other hand, we may perhaps boil down this to the question whether Buddhism, when it adopted divination manuals, were just not trying to snub ordinary people. But on the other hand, I think, or in general, I would say it is, you can say that establish a religion in China or Tibet without taking concerns of the ordinary people and without using divination is probably impossible. But the Kenshin Rinpoche also had another explanation. He also said that the diviner, the performer of the divination, is usually a lama, and in the process of doing the divination, he supplicates the deity, and doing that, he makes it possible that her activities can unfold. And that is good, to allow the activity and the power of the divine deity to unfold. Also, it is, of course, an act of compassion. We have to remember that the diviner has to practice the sadhana, the meditation manual attached to the divination manual, until signs occur, and that also means that he has a benefit from it insofar as his karmic veils are to some extent cleared away. That is on the side of the practitioner, of the lama, of the diviner. But on the other hand, if he for the person he divines for, it is also so that when that person has trust in the lama and in the diviner, then it is also of benefit from the Buddhist soteriological point of view. It's also of benefit for that person, because through that trust, he develops, or the person who asks for the divination develops faith. And faith is an important factor for guiding people on the path. So this is the way, basically, that Buddhist religion explains that divination can be beneficial even from the perspective of practicing Buddha Dharma. There are also, in this particular divination of Achi, questions possible concerning the Dharma practice directly. So you could ask a question about the appropriateness of a spiritual practice that you plan to do, or of a retreat place, whether it's free of demons, or what can be done to get rid of the demons there and so forth. So it also has one category for Dharma practice. In general, however, the Rinpoche said, or my informant said, that there is not so much a distinction to be made between Dharma practice and actual everyday activities, because especially in the context of divination, when you are concerned about business and trade and making money, making wealth, if you use it in a good way, for example, if you make offerings to the monastery, you support the spiritual institutions of your country and so forth, it also produces merit, karma, good karma for you. And therefore, it is supposed to be seen as creating favorable conditions for one's future life in the Dharma. And all that is then explained as being the activity of the deity. So this is the awakened activity that unfolds from the deity through the divination. Another very important point is the third part of my presentation, is the way divination was seen through Mahayana Buddhism. One of the important features of Mahayana Buddhism is that the reality is seen as twofold. There is the surface level relative truth, and there is the so-called absolute truth level. And that's also, of course, connected with our deities. You have the usual mundane gods, and you also have the Buddhist gods that are bodhisattvas on higher levels, or even Buddhas themselves. And when we see this in the connection of, for example, the Prajnaparamita, which is one of the most important Mahayana texts, also known, of course, in China, they speak of the three spheres of the notion of an agent, of a patient, and of an action. And some Buddhist traditions completely dismiss this threefold sphere, because they say this is just an illusion, this is completely false, and they accept as truth or reality only a sphere where these three, action, agent, and action, is completely dissolved. For example, in the Chinese sudden awakening schools, they would only accept a truth where these three are completely dissolved. But the Tibetan Buddhist schools are usually not sudden awakening, they are rather gradual awakening schools. And so the three components are an essential tool in the practice, because it is through an agent and so forth, and through action, that merit is produced, that merit is necessary on a gradual path. So they see these essential tools, the three components, as a part for the purification of the mind and of merit accumulation. And in the end, this is dissolving by itself. And the example is usually the two wooden sticks that you rub together, and they catch fire and then they burn up. That's from the Kashyapa Parivarta Sutra. In the same way, if you accept this threefold division of reality into agent, action, and patient, then this works as purification for the purification and merit accumulation practices and in the end it dissolves itself. In terms of divination, of course, we have the diviner in the divination and the receiver of the divination. And we can see that similarly, through such practice and through such making of divinations and receiving of divination and so forth, as we said in the beginning, the veil of karma is lifted. Through this kind of spiritual practice, when you see it in a spiritual context, this divination also helps to lift the karmic veils and to lead people onto the path. In this context, the Rinpoche quotes a famous verse by Baba Viveka: wanting to climb to the top of the great mansion of absolute truth without the ladder of pure relative truth is not suitable for the learned one. And so this is the classical place and the classical quote in Buddhism to show that relative truth and this kind of threefold sphere of reality and so forth has its place also in a salvific process on a path. So translated, we could say that conventional practices like divination are a ladder leading to the absolute level of reality. So if we go back to the question that we asked here, that I asked my informants, whether divination would be a positive sign in a dream, because it's only a confusion, or whether it is not a negative sign because it also purifies something, the answer is clearly yes. You can see it as something that helps on the path because it purifies some veils. So now to the fourth part my talk today. Here in this last part, I want to reflect on this process through which Buddhism absorbs seemingly foreign elements. And I hope that thereby, through these reflections, I can receive or create an impetus for reflections on the high mobility of divination texts and divination structures and techniques across languages, cultures, and distances. My first question is divination alien to Buddhism? And there was a long discussion actually in the academic literature, and the consent was for a long time that the Pali Sutras, the early Pali Sutras teach that the Buddha condemned divination together with other unworthy practices. But in 2014, David Fiordalis published a nice article where he showed that the main point in early Buddhism is that it is wrong for an ordained person to make a living out of these practices, to do them for a profit. Yeah, and he also showed that the Buddha himself has, according to old sources, given predictions on several occasions. And so we can conclude from this brief excursion that the prediction as such is certainly not alien to Buddhism. Already in India, but also later in China and Tibet, Buddhism found in its milieu already existing divinatory practices that were in all countries incorporated into Buddhism. When I use the term incorporated, I do that in a very naive way. Yeah, I have no preliminary theoretical considerations. I'm just using it now to find any term for this process of getting a seemingly foreign element into Buddhism. Secondly, my question is, are there parallel processes in Buddhism that we can look at in order to get a broader picture of how such incorporation process happens? And the answer is, actually, there are many parallel processes. For example, consider this depiction here. In the middle, you have a Buddhist deity, Avalokiteshvara, the red Avalokiteshvara, and it is surrounded by 16 deities, and all of them are pre-Buddhist. Yeah, none of them is a Buddhist deity as such. Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and so on are Hindu gods or Brahmanical deities. Or you see here a picture of the Buddha himself surrounded by the Buddhas of the medicine Buddha mandala. But at the same time, you see here at the bottom exactly the same deities you saw here surrounding the Buddhist deity. So we have them in the periphery or at the bottom of art depictions. Or here you have a Buddhist deity, Vajrapani, one of the first tantric deities actually, trampling on Brahmanical deities, in this case Brahma and Indra. Or here you have a nice depiction of a six-armed Avalokiteshvara, the Buddhist deity, riding on top of an old Hindu or Brahmanical deity. I think it's a misdepiction. It should be Vishnu, but it's depicted as Rahula, but that doesn't matter. So gods like Brahma and Vishnu, who are not of Buddhist origin, appear in these depictions. Can we say that they are not Buddhist? I mean, they are definitely pre-Buddhist, but they appear in this pantheon. They have a role here, yeah, either in the periphery or at the bottom, and or beneath the feet of Buddhist tantric deities. But the violence in these images should not distract us. They are trampled upon, but I would argue that they still are part of the Buddhist pantheon. But there are in these tantric texts concerned, for example, in Chakrasamvara Tantra, you find the story how the Buddhist deity Chakrasamvara occupies a Brahmanical mandala and suppresses all the deities on it, the Brahmanical deities, even kills them, and then revives them and binds them by oath to become protectors of Buddhism. So although it looks like that, it is not per se a hostile Buddhism versus Hinduism or Brahmanism. It is rather, when you look at it from an emic perspective of Buddhism itself, it is a conflict with a pre-Buddhist deity that personifies afflictions like desire and hatred. Shiva, for example, personifies for the Buddhist desire. And this is the doctrine of transformation, of tantric transformation, where the afflictions are transformed into awakening activities, and this is symbolized in the art as the killing and suppressing, transforming, reviving, and allocating them to new places in the mandala. Yeah, and they play. Thus, we can see that these deities have a clear role in the Buddhist pantheon. Brahmanical gods like Brahma, Chakra, Indra, Maheshvara, and so forth also occur in the life story of the Buddha. We should not forget that it was very early in one of the first sutras, it was Brahma who begged the Buddha, who requested the Buddha to teach. He didn't want to teach. And according to that sutra, Brahma asked him to do that. So he plays, in this case, an enormously important role in the Buddhist pantheon and the Buddhist story of the life of the Buddha. We can also see them appearing in sutras as observers, as requesters of teachings, as proclaiming the Buddha to be a Tathagata, as acting as assistants to the Buddha, interlocutors, as devotees, and so forth. There are also statements in numerous Buddhist texts that mention the acceptance of non-Buddhist rituals and mantras within the Buddhist fold. For example, in this Tantra, the Manushimulakalpa Tantra, it says, those numerous rituals described in the non-Buddhist, that's my edition, Vaishnava Tantra, are salvific devices for beings to be trained once pronounced by Manchu Gosha. The meaning of that is, what this text wants to say is that once a Buddhist deity has utilized a non-Buddhist or a pre-Buddhist ritual, it henceforth can be viewed as a salvific device within, in the Buddhist sense. That means leading to, on the long run, at least leading to the goal of awakening. So what can we perhaps learn concerning the process of incorporation of divination texts and techniques in that are so highly mobile, like these deities between Brahmanical and between Brahmanism and Buddhism and so forth? So first, what is actually the relationship between this Brahmanical and the Buddhist deities? Never mind the left side, this is only Sanskrit, but the same is translated on the right side, a bit of Buddhist cosmology, so to speak. The whole reality, so to speak, as I said, is divided into a relative realm and an absolute realm. And in the relative realm is down here, the mundane path of the worldlings, the path of accumulation and the path of preparation. But then we have this line here, this dividing line, which is also interrupted. It's not a strict line. I'll come back to that later. Then there are the bodhisattva levels. Once you get through from here to that level, you are on the 10 bodhisattva levels and the 3 bodhisattva paths of seeing, of practice, and of no more learning. So these deities of Brahmanical heritage and Buddhist deities are placed through Buddhist texts in these two levels, and the Brahmanical deities may occupy very high levels. For example, they can be gods. They can occupy the highest level of samsara, but they would be still within this realm here, the mundane path of the worldlings, because they are dominated by karma and their surrounding also changes and so forth. So they, by definition, they cannot be absolute deities as the Buddha is and the higher bodhisattvas are. But this is actually not as rigid as it seems. I think I'll come back to that in a minute. Let's first look at this depiction of it. If we look at this, we can see how much dynamics there are. According to this view, we can say that the three great religions in India, Jainism, Hinduism, or Brahmanism, and Buddhism, somehow overlap when it comes to all these deities. They share many deities, they share many rituals, mantras, and so many views, for example, karma and rebirth and all that. All that is shared. And that forms here a kind of, whatever we want to call it, a symbiosis or whatever. And within the emic view of Buddhism, there is a dividing line. And only the Buddhist teaching, the Buddhist doctrine, has the transmundane level. All the Jainist and Brahmanical deities are seen to belong to this level of relative truth of samsara, no matter how high they are. But when I say dynamics, there is the possibility of certain exchange. Bodhisattva or people of lower levels can become bodhisattvas. They can also fall down and lose their bodhisattva status. And more important for us, Hindu deities, Brahmanical deities, can make it into the Buddhist mundane realm, and they can even go up into become real Buddhist deities. Very few of them have made that, but there are examples of Brahmanical deities that become fully awakened Buddhist deities in the doctrine of Buddhism. So, there are many different concepts developed in by scholars in the past concerning these different levels in religions, with the popular and the learned sphere, or the lay and the monastic community, or the ordinary believer and the religious specialist, or Weber's distinction to this worldly and otherworldly, or the profane and the sacred by Durkheim, Kamik and Nibbanik, or little tradition, great tradition. We all have heard of some of these. But I think that many of them are a little bit too rigid, and this, at least this idea, this model, has the advantage, has several advantages. One is that it is dynamic, and the second is that we find it in Buddhism itself, when they differentiate in mundane and transmundane deities. However, I must admit that it is not completely unproblematic, because although it is an emic differentiation into mundane and transmundane deities, at the same time it is a doctrinal perspective, and it is of course not a socio-historical fact. So the question remains actually what went on the ground. Did this reassignment of Brahmanical deities into different places in the mandala go smoothly, or did it cause conflicts with the converts to Buddhism? Was it necessary, but a perhaps contrite concession to the converts? Or is it a sign of a religious tolerance? Or is it perhaps in Buddhism's self-interest, for example, when Buddhism occurs in a context, in an Indian context, and then has Brahma asking, requesting the Buddha to teach? Yeah, to some extent we can see that there is an element of tolerance in it, because we know in old texts that the Buddha is supposed to have said to converts that they were not only allowed but even encouraged to bring their deities with them and to continue ritual practice. And we know from southern Buddhist countries that the worship of pre-Buddhist deities, of nature gods, continued. For example, in Sri Lanka, we know that there's a continuation of cults of pre-Buddhist deities of Indian origin. And the same phenomenon, of course, we can see in Tibet, and we can also see it in China. It's quite interesting, by the way, that the Chinese book of consecration is also so that the Hindu god Brahma, went to the Buddha and told him, here I have this 100 spirit, this 100 stanzas to serve as spirit tablets. And the Buddha then agreed that this could be taught to the public, and in that way Chinese Buddhism legitimized divination. It's quite strange that they used a Hindu deity to do that. But it probably mirrors what the way the Buddha was requested to teach in India. In Tibet, there already existed divination practices of the pre-Buddhist Bumbos. The question is, why didn't they simply incorporate these into Buddhism? Perhaps they did to some extent. We know very little about it, but it is at least so that in later Buddhist divination manuals in Tibet, these older Bumbo techniques are very difficult to trace, if at all. They have a different flavor. They are rather imported from China or from India. So why is that? It seems to be the case that this was not done, the Bumbo material was not simply incorporated in Buddhism, because according to these old stories, the old legends that we can read in annals of Buddhism from the 11th, 12th century, it is so that Tibet was, before Buddhism came to it, of course, a demoness. So this is not only the body of a demoness, it is also at the same time a map of Tibet. And the job of the new coming Buddhist would be to stake her down, to pin her down by building temples, for example, on her heart and on her ankles and so forth. And so since the old was probably seen as being connected with the pre-Buddhist religion and so on, for these techniques to find these spots in the Tibetan landscape where you had to pin the demoness down, they needed something fresh. They needed a new input from somewhere else. Yeah, and that was, according to these chronicles at least, it was the Chinese input. They sent envoys to China to either get divinations there or also to import, to learn techniques. They brought them back, and according to Tibetan chronicles, it was a Chinese princess that helped identifying these spots, as far as I remember that, or in the Ba chronicles. So, coming to the end now, when we think about these ways that of transferences, of mobility, of deities, or of techniques, or of texts, and so on, between religions, or across cultures, and of course, also across languages, and it's in their incorporation into new superstructures like Buddhism. Many scholars have suggested concepts like symbiosis or cultural borrowing or transculturation or syncretism or Paul Hucker's inclusivism and so forth. But perhaps these, at least at the moment, to me, it seems that these concepts are a little bit too grand for that. It is astonishing that these highly mobile structures and techniques, I think, have not caused much transformation in the superstructures, although that is maybe something that we could debate. But I have the feeling that they were relatively easy incorporated without much change to the superstructure. And also, looking from the perspective of the superstructure like Buddhism, incorporating these elements didn't have to be changed much. They just took the techniques and added a Buddhist deity to it, and that's it, basically. Yeah, you could find literally the same technique and the same dice and the same numbers and everything somewhere else in another religion, in another culture. Just take it to Tibet, put the Achi deity on top of it, and a sadhana, a practice with her, and that's it. It works. It is a Buddhist divination manual that you get from that. Yeah. Actually, my 3 days ago or 4 days ago, I discovered that my divination manual of Achi exists 3 times in Tibet. Literally, word by word, the same technique, the same numbers, the same divinations, and the same categories are in other texts, but there's 3 different deities. One time it's Makso Gyalmo, one is Pelin Lamo, one is Achi. They just exchange the deities, and it's different Buddhist traditions too, but these texts and these structures and techniques and so forth are highly mobile, and there is not much change needed in order to adopt them or in order to put them there. So I think that maybe these concepts of symbiosis and so forth are maybe a little bit too big for what is actually going on. But I would be interested in your opinion in this. You have much more experience in looking at these things than I have. Another question that I would have is, what are the driving forces behind this astonishing mobility? Is it simply the need of the people? But that can't be it alone, because otherwise the Tibetans would have incorporated just the Bumbo manuals. Is it what Hakka called inclusivism, the strategy of declaring central conceptions of alien religions or other superstructures as being identical with one's own conceptions? But I think that doesn't work really, because the mobile elements in divination are not that central. They are just techniques. They don't have anything to do with a special worldview, as far as I can see. But again, that would be something that I would like to discuss. Or is it, as mentioned, just a form of religious and cultural tolerance and flexibility? And another question I have is, what roles play the particular preferences for certain structures and forms for a given culture? For example, the Tibetan preference of Indian and Chinese cultures. What roles play the strong bonds between Indian and Tibetan culture or Chinese and Japanese culture? And even what role plays the formation of diplomatic relations, as in the case of the Tibetans who went to China to bring a princess for the emperor who brought divination manuals with her. Maybe picking these divination manuals was part of a diplomatic effort. And of course there are fundamental problems like questions which elements could be seen as familiar or alien to any given culture, and on what grounds do you say that something is familiar or alien? So to summarize, 4 points, since the second spread of Buddhism in Tibet, the 11th century roughly, Buddhist deities of the supreme soteriological level have been simply attached to pre-existing divination structures and techniques that were imported from places like China and Central Asia, and then they are Buddhist. Secondly, these divination structures and techniques were, without the attached Buddhist elements, not inherently Buddhist. Yeah. And thirdly, they were brought into the fold of Tibetan Buddhism by means of the teachings of the Two Truths, which accept a gradual approach to awakening, and thereby they were incorporated into what we could say the Buddhist ideology or doctrine. And finally, the comparative study of divination obviously has much to contribute to general cross-cultural studies of human and cultural phenomena, particularly in my view with respect to what we could call a common ground between cultures and the problem of mobility between these cultures. Yeah, so far.